tonight to play the Thunder. The Bulls are off. The forecast today, cloudy, foggy, and windy. A high of 43, winds up to 30 miles per hour. Right now, wind northeast at 12. It is foggy. Headlights on for safety. 39 Kenosha, 36 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For this first morning show of the month of February, Black History Month, we have a newly recorded interview that centers on a largely forgotten story from the Civil War. And then from the archives, a conversation with Black historian Howard Dotson, author of Becoming American, The African American Journey. Here's part one. Just when you think you have heard every important story to emerge from the American Civil War, there comes another story that enlarges our view of that conflict. And such is the case with a remarkable new book called Kidnapped at Sea, The Civil War Voyage of David Henry White. This is the story of the capture of a free black teenage sailor from Delaware by the name of David Henry White when the ship that he was working on was captured, if you will, by a Confederate vessel, the CSS Alabama. And sadly, tragically, this young man who serves against his will on the Alabama for some 600 days loses his life in the sea battle in June of 1864 in which this Confederate vessel went down to defeat. The book Kidnapped at Sea tells us just about all that is possible for us to know about this young man and his ordeal, and more importantly, the whole story of the CSS Alabama and the havoc which it created on the seas, capturing dozens upon dozens upon dozens of U.S. merchant vessels during the Civil War. It's a fascinating story told very, very well by my morning show guest, the author of this book, Andrew Sillin, a visiting research scholar in the Department of Anthropology at Rutgers University and a former professor of paleoanthropology, founding director of the development at the University of Cape Town, and also vice president of institutional advancement at Brooklyn College. He has done an amazing job of bringing to light this largely forgotten story. The book is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. And Andrew Sillin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, well, thank you for welcoming me and thanking you for that lovely introduction.
So you tell us that you have been fascinated by the story of the CSS Alabama for some time, and tell us in the preface of the book that that fascination with the CSS Alabama began in what you call a somewhat random and unlikely encounter in, of all places, South Africa. Explain when this was and exactly what happened that piqued your interest about this Confederate vessel.
Well, I went out to South Africa in 1985 to be a senior lecturer in archaeology at the University of Cape Town. And as you indicated in your introduction, I'm not a historian by training, I'm a prehistorian. So the archaeology department, and since my area was African prehistory, an archaeology department in South Africa was a natural place for me to end up. And one day I was walking in downtown Cape Town. I had gone downtown for a haircut, and I happened to see a sign on the sidewalk for the Cultural History Museum. And the sign said, free admission on Wednesdays. And I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. I had a bit of time. I stepped inside this museum, and I was astonished to see a giant Confederate battle ensign. And as an archaeologist, I was trained to look at artifacts in their context. And this artifact seemed to me to be totally out of context. What was a Confederate battle ensign doing in South Africa. I just couldn't figure it out, and I felt that as one of the few Americans living in South Africa at the time, I almost felt it was my personal responsibility to learn more about it. And that began a long research journey, which initially focused on the Alabama itself, and also the vessel which eventually vanquished it on June 19th off Cherbourg, June 19th, 1864. And I actually spent a few years on and off researching what I thought would be a kind of meditation on the leadership qualities of the captains of these two vessels that met up in a very climactic battle off Cherbourg. That is Raphael Semmes of the Alabama and a man named John Ancrum Winslow, who was the captain of the Kearsarge, the boat that eventually vanquished the Alabama. But sometime along the way of my doing that research, which was pretty much a hobby and a sideline, I encountered David Henry White in Semmes' memoirs. And in his memoir, he describes White as a slave that he had taken from a Union packet ship, the Tonawanda, and had, in effect, freed him and gave him the pay of his station on the Alabama, and that White served as a happy and contented servant throughout the voyage. And I felt, you know, this just didn't sound right. I mean, that might have sounded right in 1869 when he wrote it, but my reading it, you know, in the early 21st century, I just thought, you know, this cannot be correct. And I felt compelled to investigate that. And it wasn't really that hard to find the information I was looking for. It was a matter of asking the right question. And the question I asked was, well, who was David Henry White and what was he doing on the Tonawanda to begin with? And I discovered through archival research that White was free. He was a cook on this vessel. He had signed on willingly under his own volition. In fact, under contemporaneous Delaware law, he was free from the day he was born until the day he died. And so my book is, in effect, a forensic description of that documentation and a documentation that almost everything Semmes had to say about White was a lie. Hmm. In service of the trope of the contented slave, happy and content in servitude.
You say at one point, the perspective, if not the methodology, of an archaeologist is perhaps appropriate in telling White's story. And of course, I think what you're getting at there is the fact that although you were able to find some information, none of it would be, in a sense, on the surface, easily accessible, immediately accessible. I mean, it really took some figurative and perhaps even some literal digging in order to uncover all of the information, which you ultimately did.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, in fact, the word I use is excavation. Archaeologists excavate the ground. In this case, I was excavating the archives. But in many ways, the intellectual process is very much the same. And in terms of perspective, I think what archaeologists bring to the story is that we're used to studying people that left no written record of their existence. David White was illiterate. There's very little information about him. There's some documentary evidence, but not much. And archaeologists are looking all the time at people that for whom there's no documentary evidence at all. And so we're compelled to use alternative methods of investigation in order to learn as much as we can about the people that we study.
We're speaking with Andrew Sillin about his book Kidnapped at Sea, The Civil War Voyage of David Henry White. David Henry White was a free black teenage sailor who was kidnapped by the captain of the CSS Alabama, a Confederate vessel. And one of the things I wanted to be sure to ask you about is this matter of reading the accounts left by certain officers on the CSS Alabama, including the captain, Captain Semmes, who wrote what I suspect can be charitably described as a self-serving memoir titled Memoirs of Service Afloat During the War Between the States, in which he, as you have already indicated, described this David Henry White, who was kidnapped, in terms that would give the impression of him being very contented, perhaps even welcoming his new lot in life as serving aboard the Alabama. This is an example, that is Semmes' memoir, an example of what's called lost cause literature. And I think it would be interesting just for a moment to talk about this phenomenon of lost cause literature. And for someone like you looking at that, how do you look at it? In what way can this kind of literature, slanted as it is in its perspective, be useful to you and others in uncovering a more unvarnished truth?
Well, I think when we look at what Semmes had to say about White and do a kind of forensic examination of it, it turns out that almost everything he said was a lie, and one that is easily documentable. For example, you know, one of many lies is he says in his first opening sentence, he says, "I took on board of her one of her passengers." That is, he described White as a passenger. Well, White wasn't a passenger. White was crew, and any naval officer knows the difference. White wasn't a slave. He was free.
He was a cook, wasn't he, on that vessel? A cook?
Yes. He was a cook who had signed on as part of a team. In fact, on a vessel that was owned by Quaker abolitionists who had philanthropic concern for colored seamen. So, and another, you know, bald-faced lie is he says he gave him the station of his grade and his pay, and his condition was in every respect bettered. Well, on the Tonawanda, White was paid $15 a month, and he had the position of cook. On the Alabama, they gave him the position of boy and paid him $9 a month. So his position was, quote-unquote, bettered with a reduction in salary and a demotion. So that what we learn from this is that everything that Semmes had to say about White was untrue, and also that the passages tell us more about Semmes and the lost cause than they tell us about White. And so one implication of that is in my book I'm very careful to describe everything I can about White, his life, and his voyage before I report what Semmes had to say about him. And the passage in which Semmes described White is in the third part of the book, because I want the reader to already be familiar with White before he encounters what Semmes had to say. And so the lies are more evident and easier for the reader to arrive at conclusions by themselves. There's another part of my experience which pertains to this, which is that when I was in South Africa, I was fortunate to read a novel by J.M. Coetzee, who is a very well-known writer, South African writer, whose books have actually won both the Booker Prize and the Nobel Prize. And one of his books called, Dusklands, he relates the story of a fictional ancestor who travels from Cape Town up to Namaqualand in 1760 and encounters indigenous peoples. And it's a horrific tale, of a graphic tale of violence, torture, vengeance, lots of blood. And after relating this private account, Coetzee then provides another document, also fictional, which is the formal report to the authorities. And it's a bland, minimalist description of the miles traveled, the interesting plants, the new animals that they discovered and named, and so on and so forth. And in the public account, the private account is literally drained of its blood. And I was kind of primed, having read that, I was kind of primed to read Sims' memoir with, well, to say the least, a grain of salt. I was ready not to believe anything he wrote, and when I encountered White, that just seemed to confirm in reality everything that Coetzee had written about his literature.
We should say, just as a quick sidelight, I wish we had time to explore this, that you draw an interesting parallel between this phenomenon of lost cause literature and the narrative that has sprung up around the so-called or supposed stolen election in which Donald Trump was defeated in his first bid for re-election. And you draw intriguing parallels between the two, but we'll leave it to our readers, our listeners, to kind of sort that out and see that in your book. Let's talk for a moment about the CSS Alabama and, in a sense, its legacy in this 22-month voyage between 1862 and 1864. Just briefly describe, in a sense, the significant role that it played in sustaining the Confederacy during this conflict. What difference did the Alabama make, and what difference did it make when it finally went down to defeat in the summer of 1864?
Sure. Well, we're all familiar with the incredible and horrific carnage that took place on land during the course of the Civil War. But less well known is the battle that took place at sea and the international context of the war, which in some ways is not unlike the Ukrainian-Russian conflict in the sense that the war had become a battle of attrition. And a lot depended upon whether or not the major economic partners of the United States, notably England and France, but also other countries around the world, would recognize the Confederacy. And in the early years of the war, it was not clear whether the international community would recognize the Confederacy or not. Now, the South had a problem with the blockade, but they developed, or I shouldn't say they developed, but they employed a strategy that had long been used in the long-running European wars of the last few hundred years before that, of attacking commerce. And so the Confederacy had a number of vessels built in the UK, or they used captured vessels. There were five or six of them roaming the North Atlantic, the South Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, attacking U.S. merchant vessels wherever they could find them. The Alabama was the most effective of all of them. It had burned or captured, if you can believe this, over 60, I think it was 64 Union vessels and a warship, the USS Hatteras, during its long cruise. And the impact was enormous because it drove over half the U.S. merchant marine to find foreign flags. It drove up insurance rates by over 500%. And it had been argued by historians that the vibrant American Merchant Museum that really kind of commanded commerce on the high seas before the Civil War never really recovered from the disaster. So the Alabama was devastatingly effective. And by 1863, it was really still not clear whether France and England would recognize the Confederacy. And there had been a series of horrific battles on land. And when the Alabama was finally sunk in June of 1863, it was had an enormous impact on markets, it had an enormous impact on Northern morale. It had an enormous, it's like a gut punch to the South. And it also ensured Lincoln's reelection in 1864. So although the Alabama and the battle with the Kearsarge is not widely recognized today, for the generation that survived the Civil War, the captains, Semmes and John Ancrum Winslow of the Kearsarge, were as famous as Farragut. And the Battle of Cherbourg was as well known as the Monitor and Merrimack. Hmm. So I was very pleased in this book to be able to bring back some of that Civil War memory and draw some conclusions, as you referred to earlier, that that pertain to our situation today. And that includes the resonance of the Lost Cause with the stolen election story, but also the leadership qualities of Semmes and Winslow, leadership qualities which would probably be recognized in certain politicians alive today. Hmm.
As for the capture of this young man, David Henry White, with the capture of the Tonawanda and on which he was serving, you at one point in the book pose a really simple, disarmingly simple question: why was White singled out? Why was he taken aboard, and maybe not others? And that in and of itself is kind of an intriguing question that also it feels like it has some resonance with some of what we are seeing in our country today. Talk for a moment about that simple yet profoundly important question.
Well, a lot has to do, I believe, with timing. And that is that the Tonawanda left Philadelphia with White as a cook in September, late September of 1862. That was, if you can believe this, the end of the week after which Lincoln had published the draft Emancipation Proclamation. And the news of that would have been in the Tonawanda's mailbags. And so when the Alabama captured the Tonawanda, there can be no doubt that Semmes, who was an avid reader of captured newspapers, would have seen this, and that is likely to have enraged him. So that was one issue. The other issue is that they needed certain kinds of servants on the vessel, because the Southern officers had their whole lives been used to being served their meals by black servants, and the Alabama had a very not unusual, but it had a very interesting anatomy, in the sense that the officers ate in the rear of the vessel, their mess was in the rear, and the crew and the galley was in the front of the vessel, and there was no communication between the two. So they needed a menial to run back and forth from one end of the ship to the other if they wanted to have hot food. So part of it was their own sense of the need to have menial servants, but the other part of it was the political statement that they were making, that if the North was going to emancipate our slaves, then we were going to enslave, their population.
Right, and you go on to tell us as well that young David Henry White had no certificate of protection, and that was typical, apparently, of the junior sailors that were aboard the Tonawanda, and so he did not possess the right piece of paper that emphatically stated that he was not a slave, but in fact a free black man, and this was perhaps in that moment an excuse for taking him into custody and ultimately into a sort of slavery. Your book, of course, takes us on this long voyage and tells us, again, as I said earlier, all that it is possible for us to know at this historic distance about David Henry White and his experience aboard the CSS Alabama before the battle in which it met its demise, and David Henry White sadly met his death. I want to finish, actually, with how the book begins, with a very intriguing author's note in which you talk about kind of a vexing question in terms of how you should refer to the young man named in your subtitle, David Henry White, how you should refer to him through the course of the book. Explain to our listeners what makes that, or made that, kind of an intriguing, tricky question for you.
Oh, well, thank you for asking that. I believe you're the first interviewer that's raised that. And I do believe it's important. Part of the issue is that I had to be very careful as a white person writing about a black person not to appear to be appropriating white story. I didn't want to simply substitute one appropriation of a story for another. And so I had to address him with respect. That meant that I could not really refer to him as David or Henry. That would be a bit presumptuous, because really I don't know him. I didn't know him. We have no way of knowing how he would want to be called. And since I refer to Raphael Semmes in the book as Semmes, I thought the best thing to do was to, as a parallelism, to refer to David Henry White as White. But that raised a problem, because it's confusing in narratives to use the same term to refer to an individual with the same term as an identity that is different from his own. So how do we talk about white in a sentence where you have to also talk about white people? Can't use the same word. And so I ended up simply not capitalizing white. And that was an orthogonal decision. Now, it turns out that depending upon where you choose to read, you will find the designation white, as it applies to race, capitalized in the Washington Post, but not capitalized in the New York Times. And in the opening author's note, I refer to that and describe the logic that each of those newspapers use. And I decided that since both of those terms are currently in use and also are both defensible, that I could simply make the decision on the basis of what made the most sense for the reader and what was the least confusing. Mm-hmm. And so I end up not capitalizing white, although I do capitalize black in the text.
It's just fascinating to think about a question like that, and of course also to think about the ways in which we continue to grapple with matters of race and identity. And I do want to say that I find especially poignant the very last words of your book, in which you say, Semmes, referring to the captain of the CSS Alabama, Semmes was a kidnapper who used great gifts to obscure the truth. As for White, we can only hope that henceforth he will be remembered as a teenage black life that mattered. The book is Kidnapped at Sea, The Civil War Voyage of David Henry White. It is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. It includes numerous diagrams, and it also includes numerous footnotes, which are a clear indication of how methodically and meticulously this book has been written. Again, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, the author, Andrew Sillin. Thank you, Andrew Sillin, for giving the world this really important and fascinating book. And thank you for being my Morning Show guest today.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two features an interview recorded and initially broadcast back in 2010. It is certainly a pleasure and an honor for me to be speaking for the next few minutes with one of our country's premier scholars and lecturers on the topic of African-American culture. His name is Howard Dotson, who has been director of the prestigious Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture for more than two decades. His writing has appeared in many, many different places, and he writes with exceptional discernment about the complexity of the African-American experience through its history and in modern culture. And he has a new book to his credit, which is called Becoming American, The African-American Journey. It is published by Sterling. And Howard Dotson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, sir.
I'm really glad to be talking with you about this really fascinating book. It is put together in such a unique fashion. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you came up with the idea of combining some very interesting elements together in order to try to give us a picture of African-American history.
The publisher, Sterling Press, came to us. They have a series they've been doing on what they call a pocketbook, histories of a variety of countries, and they asked if I would consider doing one on the African-American experience. And we looked at some of the works that they had done previously and thought that it was something that we could, in fact, do, but we weren't sure that we could get it all into their pocketbook format. So we ended up expanding the format a little bit and adding some things that were not in some of the earlier books, but finding a way of presenting the African-American experience in a unique kind of presentation. It's a chronology, first of all, but a chronology of the African-American experience in the United States set in the context of both the unfolding of human history. Our goal there was to connect the African-American experience to the total history of humankind, including the history of Africa, rather than just truncated as an extension of the transatlantic slave trade, which it was not. And then the second is to place the African-American experience in the context of the global black experience, the experiences of people of African descent on the African continent, in Europe, in South and Central and America, in the Caribbean, and in other parts of the world, and to give people an opportunity to see the complexity and diversity, the depth and reach of the African-American and African diasporan presence in human history. That's what we've attempted to do, and we've tried especially to show through the African-American narrative the ways in which African-American history is, in fact, American history, and to provide some insights into the ways in which black people of all classes and of all political and cultural and other persuasions have been part of the making of this thing we call America. And I think that a quick read through the book will give you some hints in that direction.
What's particularly intriguing, of course, is that at some point, once there are Africans who have been brought to North America, we have these two chronologies side by side, African-American and then what you call the global African diasporan. And it is fascinating because even at a glance, even before we read and take in any of the specific content in these detailed chronologies, we realize that for almost all of us who live in modern America, we never think of African-American history in this way, as being this complicated a story or this long a story.
Yes, we, unfortunately, and perhaps Black History Month is partially to blame for that, we started focusing on the heroes and heroines of African-American experience, and so when people say black history, they start thinking about Frederick Douglass and W.B. Du Bois and Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, et cetera. About 25 or 30, I call my super heroes and sheroes of the African-American experience. But history is not something that's made by elites. It's made by ordinary people, grandfathers and grandmothers and great-grandfathers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers of ordinary African-American people who through struggle and through sacrifice and through hard work, have both transformed themselves and transformed this society. And what we've wanted to try to show in the American part of the book, at least, is that African-American history is American history, and that American history without African-American history is at minimum partial, and it's likely untrue in many instances.
It brings to mind a really interesting and ultimately really troubling story with which you begin your introduction, in which you talk about your studies in history and sociology and so on, all the way through a master's degree, and of what was starkly missing from your studies until, I think you said, the second year of your master's degree program. Tell us about that.
Well, I went through grade school, junior high school and high school, and undergraduate school without ever having a course in dealing with black people. And at the graduate school level, it was my second year of my master's program that I had my first course dealing with black people, of any black people at all. And it was specifically about the changing political situation in Africa that was taking place as Africa was decolonizing. But up to that point in time, no courses specifically focused on the African-American experience. And what little I learned in the segregated schools from teachers who wanted to at least introduce us to some of the heroes and heroines of the African-American experience, the people that I mentioned before. And unfortunately, black history has been largely limited at the teaching level to celebrating those individuals until fairly recently. We're getting a lot more content in the books now, and a lot more material is available. And we hope that this little book that we've put together will serve as a catalyst and an introduction to people who want to know, or either want or need to know, more about the African-American experience as a part of the American experience.
And to extend black history beyond what you call black biography. I mean, what you were describing before is too often true for too many people, that all they know about African-American history is perhaps something of the story of a few luminaries. And you're saying
that
the historical story is far richer than that and needs to be told.
It's far richer than that, and so deeply embedded in the American story that all Americans need to learn more about it. You probably won't know very much about American history if you don't know something more than we know currently about the African-American experience. So this is just a contribution to that that effort.
One thing that is intriguing in this chronology is for us to, which by the way begins, we should tell our listeners, begins 4 million years before Christ. It's interesting to see the first mention of slavery in that chronology. And the first references to slavery actually have nothing to do with the continent of Africa or Africans being enslaved. Slavery already being present in Europe. And then, of course, eventually those tentacles extend to the African continent. But the story of slavery does not begin with Africa.
It does not begin with Africa, and it does not begin with African Americans. And all human societies practiced slavery at some time. Even the great Egyptian society was a slavery-based society. And there were enslaved peoples in the many of the Asian societies, in the of course, in the European societies. The word slave actually comes from Slavs, who were whites who were enslaved at an early period in European history. So the slavery experience is not something that's uniquely African-American or African, but all too frequently it's been presented as though that was in fact the case, when the transatlantic slave trade comes very, very late in the history of slavery. And what's unique about it is that it's the first time that in a significant way there's a global revulsion against it as an institution. And that is an important marker in the history of all of humankind.
In other words, before that, slavery was to an amazing extent sort of accepted as some
normal.
Sort of norm. I mean, we think of it as a twisted norm, if a norm at all, but somehow it never ultimately took permanent root here the way it had elsewhere, although it was a long struggle to remove it.
That is absolutely correct.
I was surprised in the African American chronology to see the first mention of enslaved Africans in North America in 1526. I did not realize.
This always surprises people, and it's a very interesting fact, because most of our, even the African American history books until very, very recently, said the first Africans arrived in the United States in 1619 in Jamestown. Those were the first to arrive in a British colony, but the earlier immigrants were actually coming during the period of Spanish colonization in North America. And the first group actually come to the area around Georgia, South Carolina in 1526 as part of a Spanish expedition that brought enslaved Africans to the United States to create settlements there. The good news is that within a few months, that group of about 300 enslaved Africans revolted and ran off and settled among the Native American population.
Hmm. I was amazed, actually, that this chronology could have as much detail as it does. First of all, that much of this chronology dates back to very ancient history and, in a sense, prehistory of the very first entries. But also, even that once the historical record is kept, that nonetheless, that it is possible for us to know so much about the distant past when it comes to this African-American history, as you describe it.
Well, the good news is that over the last 30 to 40 years, people in the academy who had not paid very much attention to the African-American or African experience have taken it seriously. Over 100 African-American studies programs have been established throughout the United States, the colleges and universities. Textbooks have been rewritten, et cetera. And so there's a lot more available now than was available previously, and a lot more that we have to sink our teeth into. And it's a lot to digest. It's an awful lot to digest, but the good news is that it kind of snaps us out of our myopia and really narrow thinking about this experience, and challenges us to open our minds and hearts and our intelligence to learn a lot more about a very, very complex experience. I mean, one of the things that we miss in the telling of the African-American experience, the individuals who came from Africa to the United States were very, very diverse people from different religious and national backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. They come to the United States as much strangers to themselves as they are to their European captors. And yet, in the midst of slavery, they transform themselves into new people, new African-American people, both here in the United States and throughout the Americas. A blending, melding of their African diversity with the Native American and European diversity they encounter on these shores. So the African-American population is one of the most complex populations in the world, and I would argue it may be the most American population in the United States, because all of America's people at one level or another are part of the, if you will, DNA of African Americans. And we do ourselves an injustice by treating it as something, you know, as simply as we've been treating it in the past. And there's so much to be learned from us about our collective selves as Americans through the study of the African-American experience. Hmm.
We should mention that part two of your book is an interesting collection of various documents, several famous speeches, all springing out of this history. And it's fascinating, for instance, to realize when you pick up a book like this that probably the vast majority of us have never read the Emancipation Proclamation. I know I never had, not in its entirety. And I wonder what you were were imagining the importance would be in including every single word of a document like that in this book?
Well, the Emancipation Proclamation is a very interesting document. It actually has been given more credit than it actually probably deserves. But in the minds of people, it was a source of inspiration well beyond its actual text. And people heard that that slavery had been abolished and took it upon themselves to abolish it themselves by running away and leaving it, even though in many instances the Emancipation Proclamation only freed the enslaved population in the states that were in rebellion against the United States, which is the Southern, the Confederate states. And those states that where slavery still existed in within the Union, it did not abolish slavery at all. But people have taken it to mean that it it ended slavery completely. That didn't happen until the 13th Amendment was passed in 1865. But we thought it important to put that kind of document, to put the amendments to the Constitution that were passed that granted people, black people, the right to citizenship and the right to vote and their civil rights, et cetera, to put those as part of our legal right to citizenship in the United States. We also included the Declaration of Independence, which in my mind is the, if you will, the founding creed of America that is endorses the notion of human equality and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and justice for all people. That kind of founding creed is what really what I believe we should measure our achievements as Americans against. And we still, in my mind, the title suggests Becoming American is, yes, about the African-American journey to citizenship, but it's also about America itself as an unfinished project, one that we're still working to make real for all Americans. And I'm just very excited about that that kind of perspective on where we are, especially in this era of Mr. Obama's presidency, as he's called us to take up the challenge of making America anew, and making it, I think, within the framework of this founding doctrine, founding creed.
I think it must be amazing to you to be able to write this chronology of African-American history and have as the last entry, Barack Obama is elected the 44th president of the United States. I mean, I assume that 5 years ago, 3 years ago, even a year ago, you might not have imagined such a thing to be possible. I mean, at least at this moment in time, and yet here it is.
Well, I had worked previously in the two Jesse Jackson campaigns, and all of us worked assiduously to try to get him as many electoral votes, et cetera, as we could. But all of us did so knowing that he was not going to be the Democratic Party nominee. And I'd say that most of us, including myself, frankly never believed that we would live to see the day when an African-American would be elected president of the United States. So this is an incredible moment in my own personal history, but I think in the history of all African-Americans and in the history of America, because it it turns a corner in the African-Americans' relationship to America, especially as they've sought to affirm their rights as citizens. Electing him president comes as close as you can come to saying, finally, that African-Americans are full citizens of this nation.
That interview from 2010 with Howard Dotson, author of Becoming American, The African-American Journey. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Frank McGrath, nephew of our news director, Dave McGrath, he and his family were caught up in the horrific Eaton wildfire that all but destroyed their community of Altadena, California. We will hear his story tomorrow. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois: cloudy, foggy, and windy today, a high of 43 degrees, winds up to 30 miles per hour. Cloudy overnight as we drop to a low of 20. Tomorrow, cloudy, breezy, and a high of 28 degrees. On Wednesday, look out for a 70% chance of rain, freezing rain, and snow. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.